Hello and welcome to The Reset, a mental health podcast without all the bollocks. I'm Sam Delaney. My guest this week is the best-selling author and New York Times columnist David Brooks. David's latest book is called How to Know a Person. In it, he explains why the best way to form a meaningful relationship with anyone, from a friend to a relative to a work colleague, is to make them feel seen, heard and understood. But of course, it's easier said than done. A lot of our closest relationships are often just transactional. We make brief inquiries like, how are you? But we barely listen to the responses sometimes. Could it be that if we all made more of an effort to let the people around us know that we were genuinely engaged with them, they might benefit us as well as them? David thinks so, and his beautifully written book sets out exactly how it can be done. It was a real pleasure reading his book and talking to David about this fascinating and inspiring subject. I hope you enjoy listening to our chat. David, welcome to The Reset.
Oh, it's good to be with you.
It's a real pleasure to have you here to talk about this wonderful new book of yours. First of all, let's talk about your own personal journey, because you describe yourself as, I guess, not the warmest or the most open emotionally growing up. Your background wasn't one where feelings were shared naturally. And then you had a kind of an epiphany later in life, and it changed completely. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I opened the book by saying, if you remember the movie Fiddler on the Roof, you know how warm and huggy Jewish families can be. And I come from the other kind of Jewish family. And so I don't know if this is insulting to the Brits, but the phrase in our culture was think Yiddish, act British. And so a little emotional reserve, as I think befits the Emerald Isles. And so I grew up, you know, we had love in the home, but we didn't really express it. We weren't huggy. We didn't say, I love you. We were pretty intellectual. And so if you came to our dinner table, you were likely to get a little conversation about Victorian funerary monuments or the evolutionary sources of lactose intolerance. and I grew up that way. I went to a very cerebral school, the University of Chicago. I went into writing, which is kind of a solitary profession. And so if you had met me sort of age 30 or 40, I think you would have thought I was a decent enough, pleasant enough guy, but not easy to get to know. And not someone anybody would confide in. And so I just didn't communicate that sense of that we're vulnerable together, that I'm someone you can get close to, in part because I was probably always on the move, a little too much efficiency mindset. And then around about middle age, I decided if you cut yourself off from emotion, from intimacy, you've cut yourself off from life itself, and you've cut yourself off from social connection. So I did, I wanted to learn more about my emotions. So I did what any University of Chicago graduate would do. I wrote a book about emotions called The Social Animal. When I was at Chicago as an undergrad, my friends and I entered him in what's known as the Golden Gloves, a boxing competition. But we didn't practice boxing. We just read a lot of books about boxing. And so my friend, he was defeated in 29 seconds. But so I wrote a book about it. Then I wrote a book about character formation called The Road to Character. And it sort of worked. I became more emotional. I became more emotionally open. And then I think what really happened was I went through a bit of a hard time about 10 years ago, in 2013 or so, when my kids were leaving home for university, my marriage had fallen apart. And I realized I had I had a lot of work friends, like people I could have lunch and talk politics with, but I had no weekend friends, the kind of intimate friends you call at 2 a.m. And I did what any male idiot would do, which was I tried to work my way out of the problem just by being a workaholic. And so if you had gone into my kitchen, I wasn't having anybody over, where there should have been silverware, there were Post-it notes, and where there should have been plates, there were stationery. And so I just tried to cover everything over in work, and that led to sort of a crash. And really a hard time of suffering. And my favorite saying about suffering is from Paul Tillich, a theologian from the 1950s or 60s. Those moments of suffering we have interrupt your life and remind you you're not the person you thought you were. They carve through the floor of the basement of your soul and reveal cavities below, and carve through that and reveal cavities below. So those hard times, you just see deeper into yourself than ever before. And so you're either going to be broken by suffering or broken open. And happily, I was broken open. I became more vulnerable, more emotional. And, you know, and just to conclude, I can prove it to you that I've become somewhat different. I mean, I constantly get it from my friends. You are so different. You are so different than you used to be. I was interviewed by Oprah twice in my life in 2014 and 2019. And after the 2019 taping, she pulls me aside and said, "David, I've rarely seen anybody change so much. You were so emotionally blocked." And so she should know, she's Oprah. And so it has been a bit of a softening as I've aged.
Yeah, sounds like a huge softening. Just going back to that, the tough period of suffering that you feel was pivotal in all of that. How did you actually get through that at the time? What was it, delving into this in a journalistic way, or did you seek other kinds of help?
Yeah, I think one, I just had to stay in the pain. There's a Henry Nouwen is a writer who died probably 20 years ago, and he says in those when you're in pain, you have to stay in the pain to see what it has to teach you. And I was like, screw that, I want to get out of the pain. I did, and I think I was aware of sort of I've been leading my life in a safe way. My fear of intimacy, fear of emotions, fear of being hurt. The second thing I learned in that period is that you need, when you're down in the valley, you need somebody to reach in and pull you out. It's very hard to do it on your own. And so two things happened. First was I was accepting all dinner invitations in those days, and I got invited to a couple's house named Kathy and David. And they had a kid in the DC public schools, and he had a friend whose mom had some drug and health issues. And so they said, "Well, James can stay here if he has no food at home or no bed at home." And so James had a friend, and then that kid had a friend. And by the time I have dinner over there, there are about 40 kids around the dinner table, teenagers, and about 14 mattresses around the house. And so I went over, and that was sort of a chosen family. And I went over to that family's house for about 6 years. Every Thursday night, we did holidays together. We did vacations together. And so those kids, those 30 or 40, we call them kids, they were really ages 17 to 22, probably. They just beamed love. They did not tolerate emotional unavailability. I think it was gradually, especially over those years, that I really developed a little willingness to be open. And then I fell in love with a woman who's now my wife. And so I'm, the one test, I have these moments where I realize I've come a long way. And one of them, I was at a conference, and they handed us lyric sheets, and it was a love song. And they said, "Pick a neighbor in the crowd, pick a stranger in the crowd, and sing the love song into that person's eyes." And if you had asked me to do that 20 years ago, I would have spontaneously combusted. But I did it. I found some guy, I sang the love song into his eyes, and so little bits of emotional progress.
It's amazing. Do you mind my asking, what's your ex-wife think of you now? I mean, do you speak to her much? Has she commented on the changes that you've undergone?
Yeah, we speak. We're raising our kids, but we haven't really talked about that, and we have an agreement not to go public about our relationship. Like, we don't talk about our relationship in public. That's our agreement.
That's fair enough. So that's really interesting stuff. Just going back to your sort of upbringing and your time at, university and so forth, I've observed the sort of thing that you're talking about a lot. I'm British, so I've seen people who might have resembled the old you a lot, and a lot of the time it is people who regard themselves as almost too rational and too intellectual to engage in emotions, i.e., they think there's a way of explaining every feeling, or that feelings are irrational and therefore are silly in some way. Was that you? And do you observe that being a common problem amongst people who perceive themselves to be intellectual?
Yeah, I think I just was intellectual. I never had great faith in the power of reason. Two of my heroes are David Hume and Edmund Burke, and they both had limited faith in the power of reason. I've always shared that. It's just that I think you can ward yourself off from the world. One of my heroes is a guy named Frederick Buechner, who's a novelist, and he had something horrible happen to him. His dad took his own life when he was nine, and they never mourned. There was no funeral. The mom just took them away to the Bahamas, and they just were in denial. And so he was in denial till middle age, and he had the same sort of process that I had. I need to see inside myself, I need to grieve my father. And by middle age, he was thinking about his father all the time. And by old age, he was crying. He would cry over his father. And it took him a life long to really grieve. And he says, what we want most in the world is to be seen in all our fullness. And what we fear most is to be seen in all our fullness. And so he says, we have to learn in life that sometimes we just need to tell our secrets. And if we tell our secrets, then we won't fall for the polished story we pretend to tell about ourselves to the world, to make the world like us. And if we tell a few secrets from time to time, we'll make it easier for other people to tell secrets. And that's really the way human bonding is formed. So I had to go through that process.
And it feels like a lot of us in life have to hit a crisis in order to get to this stage. And I guess one of the things in your book is, wouldn't it be great if we didn't have to hit a crisis? Wouldn't it be great if young people could learn this stuff from an early age? I mean, I'm in full agreement about that. Do you think the sort of ideas that you write about in your book could be the sort of things that we taught in schools at an early age?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to become wise, I do think you have to experience life. Whenever somebody says, you know, whenever I ask somebody, what made you the person you are? Nobody ever says, oh, I had a fantastic vacation on the beach and that really was like transformed me. It's usually some hard thing and some period of struggle. Nonetheless, I believe that to be a moral person and to be considerate to others and to know others is just a set of skills. How do you be really good at conversation? How do you listen well? How do you sit with someone who's suffering? How do you ask somebody on a date? How do you end a conversation gracefully? How do you host a dinner party so everybody feels included? These are just skills the way carpentry is a skill or learning to play tennis is a skill. And they absolutely can be taught. And my book walks through the various skills, tries to teach them. But they absolutely could be taught in schools. There's no reason that, just on a trivial example, though maybe not so trivial, I saw a study, I think in the U.S., of the number of young men who've never asked anybody out on a date. And it's huge, it's high, and partly it's they suck at flirting. They don't know how to flirt. So I don't know if I'd want to have a class in flirting in high school, but if it'll lead people to have happier relationships, it might be worth it. And just how to end a relationship without breaking up with somebody. I had a student, one of my students, I teach at the university level. She had four boyfriends in her life, and all of them had ghosted her. They hadn't had a final conversation. I'm sorry, this is not working. They just vanished. And so she's filled with hurt and distrust about whoever the next guy is going to be. And I think, you know, that's partly moral weakness, but it's partly just, I don't know how to have that conversation. And that absolutely could be taught.
And you think this stuff's getting worse in younger generations because of social media?
Yeah, I hate to think that they knew how to do it in the past, but all you have to do is look at the rising depression rates, the rising suicide rates in the U.S., the percentage of people who say that teenagers, for example, who say they feel persistently hopeless and despondent is up to 45%. And so the number of people who say they have no close personal friends, that's up fourfold since 2000. And so we're somehow, our mental conditions, both in the UK and the US and in many other Western countries, are just way worse than they used to be. And I don't know, there's a lot of reasons for that. I think social media plays partly a role, but the only way to fix it is to get really good at making connections with each other.
You write some really compelling things about the key reasons for why you think this is so important. You've touched on most of them already, but let's go through it. I mean, first of all, there's a pragmatic set of reasons for this, for you know, developing this set of skills. Talk to us about those.
Well, if you're going to hire someone, you want to know if they're not just what's on their resume. You want to know if they're going to be gracious to colleagues, calm in a crisis, comfortable with uncertainty. If you're going to manage somebody, you have to be able to make them feel seen. There was a study done by McKinsey, and they asked CEOs why do people leave your firms? And the number one CEO answer was, well, they leave our firm to make more money somewhere else. And then they asked the people themselves why they left, and they said, I left because my manager doesn't recognize me. They just felt unseen by their manager. And so, if you're going to work with somebody, you have to really understand them and show that you understand them. If you're going to marry someone, you don't want to know just how they look or how much they make. You want to know how the wounds of their childhood show up in their adulthood. You want to know if their desires deeply align with your own. And so in the big decisions of life, it's just very useful to be able to understand the people around you.
And then there's a set of spiritual reasons.
Yeah, well, some of those is I just think the Iris Murdoch, the great novelist and philosopher, said, attention is the essential moral act, the way we attend to each other. And she says, most of us look at the world through self-serving eyes. We see other people as instruments for us to use. And she says, what we want to do is cast what she called a just and loving attention on others. And if you see potential in me, I'll see potential in myself. If you beam love and affection on me, I blossom. And so to me, seeing every person you meet well is it's the essential moral act. And it's an act, it's a generous act because it brings forth growth.
I really enjoyed the story you cited about Churchill's mother and her leaving a meeting with, was it Salisbury? I can't remember, but yeah, it was Gladstone and Salisbury, was it? And she left the second
meeting. And Disraeli.
Oh, sorry, Disraeli, yeah. And it sort of really, well, tell us the story because it really resonated with me. I sort of really recognized this kind of experience.
Yeah, so I make this dualism in the book between, I say, in any group of people, there are two sorts. There are diminishers and illuminators. And diminishers are not curious about you. They never ask you questions. And I find I sometimes leave a party and I think, you know, that whole time, nobody asked me a question. And so a lot of people just don't ask questions. They're diminishers and they stereotype and they ignore you. On the other hand, there are illuminators. And illuminators are curious about you and they make you feel seen, respected, and lit up. So one illuminator was E.M. Forster, the novelist about a little more than 100 years ago. His biographer wrote of him that to be with him was to be seduced by an inverse charisma, a sense of being listened to with such intensity, you had to be your sharpest, best, most honest self. And we'd all like to be able to listen like that. And then the Jenny Jerome story, she's in London in the late 19th century, and she's seated one day at a dinner party next to William Gladstone when he was prime minister. And she left that dinner party thinking that Gladstone was the cleverest person in England. And then a couple of weeks later, or sometime later, she happens to be seated at another dinner party next to Benjamin Disraeli. And she leaves that dinner thinking that she's the cleverest person in England. And so it's good to be Gladstone, to be clever, but it's even better to be Disraeli, to be someone who can bring out the best in other people. And so they walk away, you know, walking on air.
It's an incredible skill to have. And when I was reading your description of it in the book, I immediately thought of 3, 4, 5 moments in my life where people perhaps unknowingly had done that for me. You know, sometimes at moments where you really, really needed it and someone, and I think you say that it's like pointing out a quality that you yourself didn't even realize you had, but they pointed out in such a convincing way, it can really make you walk on air and it can be life-changing. And it really made me think as well, well, if that had that impact on me, imagine what a beautiful thing it would be if I could do that for other people. And it's something we all have in our power. Is it sometimes our own insecurity that can hold us back, though, from praising others or even asking other people about what's going on in their life?
Yeah, I mean, the number one reason people don't really pay attention to others is ego or too into ourselves. Sometimes it's anxiety. You got so much noise in your own head that you can't really have time or space for the other person. But I think a lot of it is what you say, it's insecurity. I interviewed a guy at the University of Chicago named Nick Epley, who was commuting to work on a train, commuter train. And he knows that human beings, more than anything else, love social life. That's what people love. And yet he was surprised that of all the people on this commuter train, nobody was talking to anybody else. They were all on their screens with headphones in. And so he's a research scientist. So the next couple months, he started paying the commuters to talk to each other. And afterwards, he interviewed them, and they were all in raptures. They said, this is the best train ride I've had in weeks. And introverts said this, extroverts said this. And his conclusion is we underestimate how much fun it'll be to talk to a stranger. We underestimate how much people really want to go deep quickly. And I can tell you, my career as a journalist, I've spent my life asking people questions and sometimes kind of intimate questions about their own lives. And how many times has anybody ever said to me, none of your damn business? The answer is zero. No one has ever said that. People are dying to talk. If you ask them respectfully about their lives, they're dying to talk about it because no one has ever asked. So getting over that insecurity, that fear that they won't like it, or that we think where they're invading our privacy, it's just not a very common fear. And so we need to get over that. And I've learned even on planes and trains, I now talk to people more, and it's fun. It's fun.
Now, this is a very pertinent area, especially right now at this moment in time. You write the third reason for why you feel it's so important to have this set of skills is, I think you say it's national survival. And, you know, the point about working pluralism and how it's more important now in the societies we live in to develop the skill to see things from different points of view. Yeah, it really resonated with everything that's going on right now at this moment. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, well, we evolved to live with bands of people pretty much like ourselves, 150 people. And now we live in these diverse, pluralistic societies. And that diversity is wonderful, but it's harder to know. It's easier to know somebody from your own culture who has a similar background. It's just harder to know other people. So you have to make an extra effort to it. And then it's especially hard to know someone across some significant line of difference. And particularly in these days, ideological differences. And so since October 7th, since the Gaza operation split up, I think across a lot of Western countries, let alone in the Middle East, people have viciously different views about the Middle East and what should be done there. And it's just become brutal to be in conversation. And in the book, I have a chapter on how to talk across ideological difference. And one of the points I've learned is that my first job when somebody comes at me with a point of view I really disagree with is to stand in their standpoint. That is to say, to ask them four or five times, what do you mean? What are you saying here? Tell me more about it. Tell me more. What am I missing? And then the second thing I try to do is get them to tell me a story. So I no longer ask, what do you believe about that? I ask, how did you come to believe that? And that gets them talking about some figure in their lives who shaped their values or some experience they had. Suddenly, they're telling a story. And if I keep asking these questions, maybe we'll never disagree, but at least I've communicated curiosity and respect. And in any conversation, respect is like air. If it's present, nobody notices. And if it's absent, it's all anybody can think about. So as we're having this disagreement on ideology or whatever, we got to be aware that there's an under conversation. There's the nominal conversation we're having on whatever subject we're talking about. But the real conversation is the flow of emotions flowing between us. And I'm either showing you with everything I say more respect or less respect. I'm making you feel more safe or less safe. And so the questions want to encourage a sense of safety. And I want to stand in your standpoint.
Is this the key to us making pluralism, which is only going to, you know, with mass migration, it's only going to become more and more of a melting pot, the societies we live in, the UK and the United States and beyond. Are the subjects and the skills you're writing about in this book, are they fundamental to all of this working?
I don't see how we can have a mass multicultural democracies without the ability to see across difference and understand each other. And that includes knowledge of different cultures. And so I once was at a dinner party and I asked, the quality of your conversation depends on the quality of your questions. So I like to ask big questions. If this 5 years in your life is a chapter in your life, what's the chapter about? And that gets people talking about, you know, what they hope to do in the next 5 years. If we met a year from now, what would we be celebrating? What crossroads are you at? What transition are you at? But one of the questions I asked at a dinner party was, how do your ancestors show up in your life? And so we're all shaped by the heritages we carry. And so I asked this at a dinner party, and there was a Dutch couple there, and they started talking about how Dutch culture shaped how they see. There was a Black couple. They started talking about how the African-American experience shaped, you know, who they are and how they see the world. I talked about coming from Jewish heritage, 5,000 years of Jewish history, and how that shapes who I am. And so being honest about each other's cultures and being curious about each other's cultures is Hey, super fun. I mean, it was a really good conversation, lasted like an hour and a half. And then it's, you want your conversations to be not just people making statements at each other, but a joint exploration. It's something we're both curious about. And I'd be like, well, how did your whatever English heritage, Scottish heritage, whatever it is, how does it show up in your life? That's just something interesting.
How do you contend with people who, once you set them off, they cannot stop and the conversation has no back and forth? It is monologuing. Because I mean, so much of, I mean, you've opened my eyes in this book. I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass here. You've opened my eyes to the nature of several long-term relationships I've had, my own failings in some of them, and certainly the ways in which perhaps I felt bad about certain relationships. I didn't realize that it was, I used to think, I don't think that person doesn't love me. I don't think that person doesn't even, I think they like me and they love me, but there's something I don't feel is right in this relationship. And then you realize maybe it's because they never ask questions or don't seem to really understand who I am or anything like that. Now, I've conversely sometimes thought the only way to deal with this person in my life is to ask them questions nonstop about themselves. That can go too far, and you can end up carrying a bit of resentment around. When someone, you give someone an inch and they take a mile. How what's our way around that, David?
And so it's sort of a how can an illuminator talk to a diminisher, and
Yeah,
can you
quite.
convert them? And so I guess I would say, I'm sitting here in Washington, D.C., the most emotionally avoidant city on the face of the earth, and I have a lot of these conversations. So I think I tell the story in the book. I was talking to a friend of mine who happened to work in the Obama White House, and I'm on my cell phone, and in the middle of the conversation, the call drops. And so I think, oh, he'll notice in a minute. He'll call me back. And so I wait 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes. And finally, it's somewhere between 7 to 10 minutes. I call his office, and his assistant says, oh, he can't talk now. He's on the phone. And I say, no, he's on the phone with me. He's been bloviating for 10 minutes, and he doesn't notice. And so all I can do is when I hit somebody who's all walled up like that, I can lead with curiosity. I ask some question about them, hoping they'll reciprocate, or I'll reveal a little vulnerability, just a little, to see if they're willing to reveal a little vulnerability. But often they're just not. And my rule is, if you invite me to coffee, say, and you talk at me for 40 minutes as if I don't exist here, I'm just an audience, then we will not be enjoying each other's company again, because that's like a
Right.
red flag for me. It's, at some point, it just
Yeah.
has to be reciprocal. And if it's not reciprocal, it's not really a relationship.
Yeah. And if and also people talk about nowadays, phrases that you hear bandied around a great deal are things like setting boundaries in relationships and being very aware of self-care. Okay. In fact, I guess what you just described is both of those things. You're setting a boundary. You're like, my boundary is I'm not going to be an audience for 40 minutes, and your self-care is I probably won't go for coffee with you again. But it's difficult, isn't it? If it's someone who is important in your life, the balance between, yes, you want to see them, you want to demonstrate that you're capable of illuminating. But at what point can that become indulgent? At what point can that become damaging to you?
So in the book, I summarize another book, a really great book called Fierce Attachments by a writer named Vivian Gornick, an early feminist writer. And she just it, the book is really about her relationship to her mother. And they spent their whole lives together really fighting, fighting over who is to blame. And so the mom, Bess, is a pretty self-absorbed, and she doesn't really see her daughter. She just sees her own drama. And then her daughter, Vivian, at one point in the book, right, it kills me not knowing her, not knowing I'm there. She doesn't even know that it kills me, but it kills me that she doesn't see me at all. And it's a, they spend their lives together. They're sort of addicted to each other, and they're, but they don't really, and they don't really know each other. And it's proof that you can love someone and be loved by someone who doesn't know you. And that happens, I think, in families. And so the only thing, the problem with Vivian, she doesn't see her mom's from her mom's point of view. She only sees the effect her mom has on her. And so we never get to know what her mom like away from Vivian. And so I think part, one of the problems with some relationships, and it could be a parental, it could be spousal, is you get locked in a way of engaging. Somebody once said there are three people in any marriage. There's the husband, the wife, and the marriage. And the marriage is the pattern of way of the way you guys relate. And I found that, you know, since I've gone through this change, we talked about being a little more open. The hardest relationships to change are the oldest, because we're stuck in an old pattern. And even though I want to behave in a different way, a more vulnerable way, and more open way, I found it very hard to fix relationships that already have their own ruts.
So, David, there was a huge amount of very useful sort of advice and you know, ideas in this book. But tell us, how can we be more open-hearted? What are your day-to-day tips about, you know, how anyone can make little changes in their life right away to feel more open-hearted and to demonstrate to the people in their lives that they can truly see them?
Yeah. So first is the gaze. We don't appreciate how much, when we're first seeing someone, or even somebody we know well, how they're going to be asked, when we meet, we're each asking a question: am I a priority for this person? Does this person like me? Can I trust this person? And those messages will be conveyed in your eyes before any words come out of your mouth. So the story I tell is, I was at a diner in Waco, Texas, and I'm sitting with this woman, a 93-year-old woman named LaRue Dorsey, and she presented herself to me as a stern disciplinarian. And she had been a teacher, and she said, I loved my students enough to discipline them. I was a little struck. I was a little intimidated by her because she was so formidable. Into the diner walks a mutual friend of ours named Jimmy Durrell. And he comes up to our table. He grabs Mrs. Dorsey by the shoulders and he shakes her way harder than you should shake a 93-year-old. And he says, Mrs. Dorsey, you're the best. You're the best. I love you. I love you. And that stern disciplinarian turned into a 9-year-old girl with her eyes glowing, just the softest creature you can imagine. And it shows the power of attention. If you just attend to somebody in a warm way, you'll bring out a different version. But the most important thing is the quality of your conversations. Like, getting to know someone just requires you to be an excellent conversationalist. And so how good are we at conversation? And the answer is, we're not as good as we think we are. And so it's the ability to take an average conversation that we're going to forget in 5 minutes and turn it into a meaningful and a deeper conversation. And so some of the tips in how to be a good conversationalist are, I have a whole list of tips in the book. Don't be a topper. If you're telling me you're having trouble with your teenage son, my instinct is to say, oh, I know what you're going through. I'm having trouble with my Tommy. And it sounds like I'm just trying to relate, but what I'm really trying to do is hog the conversation so we're talking about me and not you.
Yeah.
And so don't be a topper. Be a loud listener. I have a friend, when you talk to him, it's like you're talking to one of those charismatic churches. He's like, yeah, yeah, I agree. Yeah, amen. Preach that. And I love talking to that guy. He's just a loud listener.
Yeah.
And you can do that with facial expressions. You can do that just by showing. And then another one is simple, is treat attention as an on-off switch, not a dimmer. When you're with somebody, make sure your attention is on them 100%, not 60%. And so there's a whole bunch of tips, but just becoming great conversationalists is really the key. And, you know, it's what we do at a pub at night or whatever. I mean, these skills are everyday skills.
David, I'm really curious to know if you've noticed a difference in reactions to these kind of things across different cultures, because in the UK, you know, the stereotype that you mentioned at the beginning here and that you mentioned in the book is, you know, broadly correct. As a Brit, I would agree that we're a reserved people. But one of the things that we do in Britain that I've noticed less in America, and I've got relatives in America and spend quite a lot of time there, is that in Britain, we have a almost pathological need to make jokes of everything. Particularly self-deprecating ones.
Yeah.
And so I read a lot of the stuff in your book and it all makes sense to me. But I think, yeah, in America, people are going to, you're going to praise them and they're going to love that and light up and maybe praise you back. But in Britain, people are going to be so mortified by the praise that they're going to immediately make a joke at their own expense and then perhaps at yours as well.
Yeah.
Is this something you have noted when dealing with people from different countries and cultures?
Yeah. Somebody told me the Danes, so I've not been able to verify this, but somebody told me the Danes in Danish have a word for, I feel bad for you because you just showed too much emotion in public. So I don't know if that really is true, but it's a good word to have. Mm. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time in the UK. And obviously the level of, as you say, the level of humor, the median, as George Orwell once wrote, the median of behavior is different in England than it is in France or is in the United States. And I would say there's more joking and there's more sarcasm and a lot more.
Yeah, and we hide behind that. You know, sincerity doesn't come that naturally to us as Brits, I don't think.
Right. And Americans can be overly sincere.
Yeah.
Especially Southerners or Midwesterners, or at least the appearance of sincerity. But I would say we're all humans, and humans from time to time need someone who just can look into their eyes and see them. And, you know, even the two stories I told about the Illuminators, Ian Foster and Disraeli, they're both Brits. So,
yeah, very true.
And you look at the great art and novels that have come out of Britain. And my lesson has been to look, frankly, at the way musicians sing. And it's been a model for me. In doing this book, I interviewed tons of people from therapists to cognitive scientists. Actors were the best people to interview because actors are really good at getting to a role. And so they really have to study and they have to steal mannerisms so they know what to do.
Yeah.
And so actors taught me a lot. But I look at the way a singer is, just if you go into a little club somewhere and maybe he or she is singing for like 15 people, they're still putting it all out there. And they're just like reliving the passion of the song. And I sort of have learned to copy that a little. Like if they can do that, then I can put a little more passion into it and get cut through some of the humor, some of the sarcasm.
What's interesting to me as well is that you're doing this in your day-to-day life. Obviously, you meet a lot of different people in your job and you're very diligent and forensic in your level of research. But your day-to-day life, you know, you're spending time in Washington. So you are surrounded by people in the political world, people in the journalistic world, people in the academic world. Now, I would say that's three of the hardest, the most cynical worlds, particularly journalism and politics. I'm not so familiar with the academic world, but there's a lot of cynicism. So if you're able to operate in the worlds you live in with this kind of open-heartedness, and I suppose it's possible for anyone, right?
Yeah, I'm in a hostile work environment for this. That's for sure. And people think, you know, because we journalists ask people, you know, we're interviewing is what we do. You think, oh, you must be socially superstars. But when I walked into the New York Times for the first time, wow, what a bunch of socially awkward people. And a lot of us need the interview structure to structure our social lives because we know how to handle an interview. Mm. But a conversation, wow, that's really hard. But I have found, and say in to take the hardest of all hard cases, I would say where I'm sitting is 10 blocks from the U.S. Capitol. So I interview a lot of senators and a lot of Trump senators and a lot of Republican senators who pretend they like Trump, but who don't really like Trump. And so there's a lot of cynicism there. And I have found it's so easy to reach them on a personal level. Everybody's going through something. Mm-hmm. And a senator I know came up to me or sent me a little text saying that his wife was dying. And, you know, so whatever I think of his politics, he's still a human being down there. And human beings hunger for recognition. We all came out of the womb wanting our mom to see us, and we all want recognition to this day.
Have you ever interviewed Donald Trump?
I interviewed him before he became president, but I since he's become president, he has communicated with me, but not in a nice way.
Do you think that Donald Trump longs to be seen?
Well, yes, he desperately wants to be seen. Does he want to be known or know himself? No, there are some people who are I don't think I'm going to turn Donald Trump into some hero just by gushing warm feelings toward him. So some people have, as I say, have made themselves not the problem with narcissism. There's no cure.
David, it's been such a pleasure speaking to you and a real pleasure reading
How to Know a Person. It is a wonderful book that's really opened my eyes and my heart to a lot of, you know, hopefully positive things about relationships in my life. And I'm sure it'll do the same for anyone who reads it. There'll be a link in all the notes to get the book in the notes for this podcast. But now I wish you all the best and thanks so much for your time.
That was David Brook. His book, How to Know Someone, is out now and it's great. I put a link in the show notes. I've certainly taken a lot from his ideas and have been trying my best to implement them to everyday conversations ever since our chat. Thanks for listening as always, gang. Apologies that the episodes have been less regular of late. I'm tied up with writing a new book of my own, which is due out in 2025. It's about mental health, masculinity, work and burnout. I need to have it done by May. The irony is, I may well burn myself out trying to do it. But keep an eye out for more episodes soon and more newsletters via samdelaney.substack.com. There's a huge archive of podcasts and articles over there on my Substack, so if you don't already, please go ahead and subscribe. Fill your boots. Until next time, gang, be lucky and don't let the dickheads get you down.